Welcome to the special pledge drive edition of The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is impacted by the wider world. The actor Brad Whitford is probably best known for starring in The West Wing and doing some very bad things in a basement in Get Out. More recently, he was in Transparent and The Handmaid's Tale. Now he's starring in the new sitcom, Perfect Harmony. If it sounds like a departure, that was intentional.
I was sort of looking to do a comedy. I've been doing a lot of dark stuff.
We recorded this conversation in front of a live audience here at KPCC during our recent open house. In Perfect Harmony, which is sort of Parks and Rec meets Glee, Whitford plays a guy who's very close to the show's creator, Leslie Wake Webster.
Leslie had this story about her grandfather at the end of his life. He was a very pretentious, kind of snooty, Eastern coastal dude who ended up at the end of his life kind of stuck in Kentucky, where she is from. And he ended up finding real joy and nourishment working in this little church that he thought he didn't want to have anything to do with. And that was sort of the basis.
Lucky for you, I am here and I am taking this choir to the regional competition.
Regionals?
I thought we didn't qualify.
You didn't, but the Kentucky Choral Commission thought that a director of my caliber would add interest and, what was it? Yeah, prestige.
And I was looking for something to do in these insane, polarized times that put radically different people together and sort of transcended it in a non-preachy way with humor, and this has this added element of music.
It's not hallelujah, it's hallelujah. Open vowels. You've heard of vowels? They're the things that Pat Sajak makes you pay for.
Your character passes out.
I pass out, yeah. It was actually a tricky thing with the show because it opens on the day of my wife's funeral and I am downing sleeping pills with bourbon. So it was tricky to find how exactly to do that.
How to navigate that.
Yes.
But you do, I suspect, can make an argument about how this show is not a polar opposite to Handmaid's Tale and Transparent, even though they're very different beasts in terms of what they are trying to say, that you're working in shows that you think have a meaning beyond the show itself. And how would you define it for this show?
Well, I always hesitate to say, I always remember in 1994, I did a Clint Eastwood movie, A Perfect World. And I'm sitting on the set and I have the New York Times and the Arts and Leisure section. Big headline. He had just won the Oscar for Unforgiven, and it's Clint Eastwood's vision of America. And I go over to him and I said, "Did you see this?" And he goes, "My vision of America." He's like, "About 10 years ago, I was working with a monkey. Now they think I'm Gandhi." He's like, you know, you take the best job you can. I don't have a civic vegetable agenda which guides my showbiz choices. But I've been very lucky to be on these shows that tend to have some sort of cultural impact.
I'm going to ask you about a show that you are probably best known for, and that is West Wing.
Thank you. And look what a civilizing effect we had on the political discussion.
This is a clip that is easily found, and I think it's called Josh Lyman Yells at the President. So let's listen to it.
Josh, Didion's a good guy. We can talk to him.
You need to listen to me. You have to listen to me. I can't help you unless you listen to me. You can't send Christmas cards to everyone. You can't do it. Forget the SPR. Let's get the IMF loans like we said we were going to. Listen to what I have to say about Didion, and please listen to me.
I'm going to ask you about working with Aaron Sorkin because you had a long relationship with him. I think it started with A Few Good Men. Is that right?
It did. Young actors will always say, like, how do you get on a show like the West Wing? And the answer for me is you take a part in a movie that you don't want to do, a really important film called Revenge of the Nerds 2, Nerds in Paradise. Let me finish. And on that movie, Tim Busfield played Poindexter with the glasses and the violin. And Tim and I were kind of theater rats, and we would fly up to the one-act festival in Kentucky because we were shooting in Florida. I became friends with him. Tim replaced Tom Hulce in A Few Good Men. Tim said to Aaron, I think this guy can do your stuff. And that's how I got the West Wing. Was playing a jerk in an idiotic movie.
But what about his writing, outside of what it did for your career, about the challenges that Aaron Sorkin gives
that,
an actor?
That kind of writing, yeah.
Which is, I mean, that was a snippet of what he asks his actors to do.
Yes, you have this relentless verbal obligation. There is a rhythm. Aaron sits at the monitor going, like he hears a rhythm. And the great thing about his writing is, thank God, it's weirdly easy to memorize because there's a flow to it. Allison Janney, you know, was doing 8 shows a week for a decade before she did that. It was a lot of theater people. There's a verbal obligation. If you're doing a speech like that and there's all this, you know, political chuffa and you're really upset about something and you say couldn't instead of could not, you got to go back and get it right. He's an amazing writer who breaks all the rules. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. He wrote 22 episodes of a 1 hour for 4 years. That's the equivalent of 11 feature films a year. I got a chance after he left to write a couple, and I thought my spine was going to fall out of my back. I can't believe that he did it, and it'll never happen again. Nobody in that position will submit themselves to doing 22 a year.
We're talking with Brad Whitford about many things, including his new series, Perfect Harmony. How does your work in theater affect the choices you make, and how important is it to get back to theater?
I can't imagine doing television and film work. I would feel like I had no bones. It, you know, you do a play, I'm a pawn in storytelling is basically what I am. And if I'm doing a play in New York, I'm doing it 8 times a week from beginning, in sequence, beginning to end. It's actually weirdly organic. I remember the first time I did a movie, because you think of like Brando and De Niro, like, oh God, it's gonna be, you know, real organic on the set. It's the fakest feeling. Like you just have to immediately get over how fake it feels. There's guys, you know, touching you, you know, right before. It's out of sequence. It's in snippets. You get a good take. They go, you gotta tilt your head. Like, it's very, very technical. And you don't learn how to act without just doing it relentlessly. So again, doing West Wing felt like you were doing a play because it was so much material. It was coming at you so quickly.
As an actor, you benefit in your career when you're associated with something as successful and critically acclaimed and award-winning as the West Wing. But as an actor who is honing his or her craft, do you learn more from failure, from disappointment, from shows that don't work, from plays that go wrong than you do
that
from...
That's a very good question and a very good point, and the answer is yes. I think you should get an Oscar for making a moment in a crappy movie work because it really is the most difficult thing. And what do you get rewarded for? You get rewarded for, you know, the greatest writer in the world who gets you, and you're looking into Allison Janney's eyes. It's like a conspiracy to make you succeed. I think doing theater makes you audacious. And the great thing about doing film or television is you cannot lie. The moment you lie, you can see it on film. It's almost worse on television because people know you. You're in bed with them. It's very weird. but the one thing I consciously do try to do is I try to challenge myself. I don't want one approach to acting to work. And it's a totally different thing doing Handmaid's Tale than a pratfall. And I think mixing it up, if you're lucky enough to have those opportunities, is the way to become a better actor.
That conversation with Bradley Whitford was recorded in front of a live audience here at KPCC during the station's open house. If you were among the thousands who came to visit, thanks for attending. Coming up, there's a new Batwoman on TV, and she's unlike any other superhero.
Part of her, Kate's everyday life is that she's attracted to women, and I'm forgetting that people, you know, maybe in a small town, really see that as a gay storyline. But we don't tell a lot. We're not telling quote-unquote gay storylines, but this is a character who happens to be gay, and it is part of her everyday life.
The showrunner of the new Batwoman series is up next on The Frame Weekend. Welcome back to our special pledge drive edition of The Frame Weekend. Television has a new Batwoman.
You'll be leaving Gotham. You guys have caused enough problems for one night.
Hey, would hitching a ride in the Batmobile be out of the question?
Get out.
Ruby Rose plays Batwoman. She was in Orange is the New Black and as Batwoman had popped up in various other DC properties, including Arrow and The Flash. For creator Carolyn Dries, there was no debate that her character was going to be gay.
It was never a question. It was, of course, she's going to be gay. That's what makes her special. That is why we need to tell this story now. And the awesome part about doing Batwoman, and I don't know if it was like this for Flash or Arrow or Legends of Tomorrow, but with Batwoman, they hired me because they wanted to do my Batwoman. They wanted to do whatever was cooking up in my brain. So that was probably the coolest part of it all.
And I want to ask you about casting, because it's not just Batwoman. There are a lot of women who are in prominent roles of authority in this story.
Yes, that happened, I guess you could say, as naturally or almost, I want to say, as a mistake. It's just when you hire a woman who has some authority in the world to write these stories, she creates other women very naturally to exist in her world. So people have brought that to my attention. And then the first time they did, I was like, oh, I guess you're right about that. But that's why you hire strong women to write other women, is because that's what flows off their fingertips.
I want to play a clip. And this is where Kate finds her bat suit for the first time. Luke Fox, played by Camris Johnson, is also in this scene.
What?
That's why Bruce became Batman, to play by his own rules. Made him terrifying to his enemies.
Yeah, and his friends and his co-workers. We really need to go.
People aren't afraid anymore. An army may not scare them, but that will. I need you to fix his suit.
The suit is literal perfection.
It will be when it fits a woman.
It's really a polarizing line. A lot of people reacted negatively to that because they don't want us reappropriating Batman's suit, which I understand. Today in the news, I was reading a story about two astronauts, two women, and it was supposed to be the first time that two women go out on a spacewalk together. And one of them had to be switched out for a man at the last minute because her suit literally didn't fit and they didn't have another women-sized suit. And that was so poignant to me, because that's actually what I'm talking about. Is it's not that Batman wasn't great and that, you know, K.K. needs to step up and do his job for him. It's that the symbol of wearing this suit is what is really important, and that it's time that a woman is able to fit into the suit.
But it's also a symbol about young kids looking at a TV series and seeing somebody who looks like they might feel about themselves. And that was invisible 15 years ago, 10, maybe even 5. And I'm wondering, growing up yourself and about kids growing up today, how important it is to see somebody who thinks and behaves like you, even though they're a superhero, on screen, and what kind of comfort and validity that can give somebody watching.
Yeah, I'm so moved to think that it is providing comfort for people. It's this feeling that I can't even put into words of how surreal it is, thinking that this show is impacting some stranger in a city I've never been to. And it's just almost impossible to comprehend. And the only way I can relate to it emotionally is sort of this sense of wistfulness as I'm writing it. I'm so proud and so excited about this as a fan to be making a show like this. And at the same time, I'm nostalgic and wishing that 13-year-old Caroline had this exact show, and a little bit jealous of now the 13-year-olds who get to watch it.
We're talking with Caroline Drees about Batwoman. There's a scene in the first episode where two women kiss. And even when you have a gay or lesbian character in a TV series, what you see is often off screen, or it's alluded to, or you see them kind of hugging each other. But it felt very intentional on your part that we're actually see them make out.
Again, it was one of those things that I didn't even think about. It was just it's in the fabric of the show as I was writing it. Of course, the two love interests are going to kiss. For me, it's just an everyday part of my life, so I'm not really overanalyzing it like somebody might. But that's, I think, why, again, it's great to hire a lesbian to write lesbian characters, is it's not a thing.
Something I noticed today, and I don't know if you saw this story, you've been review bombed on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
And that's not a good thing. I mean, I think that is people who are still uncomfortable with the idea of a lesbian superhero, and they have reviewed the show in disproportionate numbers based on what that kind of show would attract kind of numerically, and they've been very critical. So I guess that suggests that people are really somehow put off by the fact that Batwoman is gay.
It's striking, and for somebody like me and the group of writers and the execs and all the creative people involved in the show, we are in a bubble in Los Angeles where, you know, I'm sitting here and we're breaking stories about, oh, this gay element. And then I'm just like, does this sound like an after school special? Does this still happen? Like, do people still hate gay people? And then you see that and you're like, oh, yeah, this isn't just something that happened 20 years ago. This is happening 300 miles away. We're just in this bubble of privilege and luxury where we're not dealing with this right now. So it's just a constant reminder of the struggles that people are going through. And it's sad. And it just shows you why the show is so important.
How much, as a storyteller, are you governed by the rules of comics, and how much are you governed by the rules of television, having worked on shows like Vampire Diaries, that what can you do and what can't you do?
I was lucky with the Batwoman mythos. It kind of had a couple starts and stops over its history in the comics, and it's not one of those super familiar comics where, you know, everyone knows how Bruce Wayne's parents died and you don't want to mess with that origin story. With Batwoman, people aren't as familiar with it, so I can take these creative liberties left and right and nobody will really know the difference. And at the same time, I want to be reverent to the existing property, so I throw in a ton of Easter eggs that the diehards really notice and appreciate. So in terms of that, the studio and the network are really open to me doing whatever I want as long as it's a compelling, dramatic, emotional story.
You have, as any showrunner has, the pressure of creating a series and making sure that it succeeds. And then you have the added pressure of this iconic character being a lesbian woman. And can you separate one from the other? Do you feel any added pressure, responsibility to make sure that it works, comes around for another season?
Yeah, I felt a huge amount of pressure a few weeks into breaking the first few episodes, I stopped the writer's room and I just looked at everyone and I said, you guys, is the show gay enough? Because I was reading all the press and everything is the first lesbian superhero, first lesbian, you know, and I was just like, wait, that's what everyone's expecting. Like, is the show even, you know, gay? And everyone's like, yes, relax. She's in love with so-and-so. She's dating so-and-so. Like, it's so gay. And I just didn't realize it, you know, because I'm so in the trenches. And again, just part of Kate's everyday life is that she's attracted to women. And I'm forgetting that people, you know, maybe in a small town really see that as a gay storyline. But we don't tell a lot. We're not telling, quote unquote, gay storylines. But this is a character who happens to be gay. And it is part of her everyday life.
And I think it's also important that Kate's former girlfriend is somebody who is to this day conflicted about what her heart tells her she should do.
Yes, I wanted to tell the sort of closeted story without it being obviously our central character. And I think Sophie's story was perfect for it because it's already been established a little bit in the comics. And what she goes through as not just a gay woman in the military, but as a Black woman We will find out more about her family and her mom and stuff like that. It's the pressures on her to succeed are unique and something I really wanted to explore.
Caroline Drees is the executive producer of Batwoman. It airs Sundays on the CW. Caroline, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, George Chambers, the leader of the Chambers Brothers, died this week. We remember his musical legacy with a conversation we had with him and his brothers.
We were in the recording room, and the engineer and the producers were in the sound control room. And after a couple of takes, there was a little break, and we were laughing and joking and carrying on. And somebody says, "I bet you those white guys ain't never heard black guys sing like that before," and it pissed them off.
The Chambers Brothers coming up next on The Frame Weekend. Stick around. Welcome back to our special Pledge Drive edition of The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. You may know the Chambers Brothers as the 1960s group behind the hit song, Time Has Come Today.
Time has come today. Young hearts can go that way.
One of the brothers, singer and bassist George Chambers, died last weekend at the age of 88. A couple of years ago, Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett met George, along with his brothers Willie and Joe Chambers. Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about the Chambers brothers' music?
I mean, just to begin with, their sound is so indicative of sibling harmony. Their voices just sound perfect together. But they were also notable because they started as a religious gospel quartet, and they would play clubs like the Ash Grove, and they talk about how they were actually like really nervous to play in places where people were drinking. That just wasn't something that they grew up with. But then, you know songs like Time Has Come Today, they became this rock outfit. They would open for people like Jimi Hendrix. Like, it's pretty amazing.
So we're going to hear your piece now. Who's the first voice we're going to hear?
Starts with Willie Chambers.
The first music singing I ever heard in my life came from my mom and my dad. After working in the fields, the singing would start. And yeah, it never did end. It just continued until everybody was sleeping and passing out, yeah, going to bed.
Now won't you go
uptown and on the mountain, over the hill and everywhere. Go uptown and on the mountain.
We were eight boys and five girls. But the four of us were born with the perfect voices to sing harmony.
We can't sit and do a whole lot of rehearsing. Spontaneously, we can get up and sing anywhere. We can be singing a song. If we decide to change that song in the middle of it, we can change the arrangement.
We can put on a concert right now.
Why won't you go?
Oh, tell it on the mountain, over the hill.
Hi, my name is Willie Chambers.
My name is Joe Chambers.
My name is George Chambers. I had gone into service, and I came out of service.
The Korean War.
Yeah. And when I got back home for after the second day, I knew then that I wasn't going to be able to stay in Mississippi because of the white supremacists, you know, the Yasser and the Nasser and all of that kind of stuff. About 3 days later, I was on my way to California. I got a job, saved all of my money, making like 70-something cents an hour working.
Wow.
And I sent two of my brother-in-laws, one had a car, back to Mississippi to move out the family. Daddy had taught us you don't have to take that if you present yourself as a man, you should be treated as a man. And I had learned to be treated as a man.
But if somehow you back up your sorrows and give them all to me.
I believe in when God gave out the talents, He said, take it and use it to better yourself.
Yeah, Mama used to read that scripture to us all the time when we were kids in Mississippi. Yeah. We didn't know what it meant, but she was telling us, you don't have to just sing in church.
And that's the way we did it. And it just took us around the world.
They were staying in Hollywood. And I decided one day, I got in my car and went up to visit with them. And I got up there and I looked over in the corner and I saw this wash tub sitting over there with a stick on it and a string. I said, what is that? And they said, a gut bucket bass. I said, that's something I could use because I like gadgets. And so it was just my cup of tea.
It's just a natural. And that gut bucket really kind of made us famous. And
because of that gut bucket bass, he's one of the finest bass players you will ever know. Real electric bass.
Oh, Sea Rider.
That first trip that we went on with Barbara Dane to Newport Folk Festival. They shipped their stuff on the train along with my gut bucket. We got to the Newport Folk Festival. Everybody's equipment got there except my wash tub.
Tub didn't make the train.
They threw it off the train.
When I returned to get on stage, I had nothing to play but that little Dan Electra bass. Four strings, and I'm used to playing one string on the tuba. So in front of 33,000 people, that's how I started playing the electric bass. I love my brothers. I love what we have done. I'm very proud of the success that we had. You know, like, I've outgrown it. I'm 86 years old, you know, like my voice is weak. And
you still got spring in your legs, man.
The devil has tried to take my hearing away to where I can't hear the notes that I'm playing because I play by ear. All of us do.
Yeah.
I have to ask one of the other musicians sometime, what key are you playing in? Because I just don't hear it. But once I get the key that they're playing in, you know I can play it.
There was a bad thing that happened to all of us in Columbia Studios in New York City. We were recording what you might consider white music. We were doing a song that we had wrote called Love Me Like the Rain.
Love me like the rain, don't shy away.
And it sounds like the Everly Brothers or somebody. And we were in the recording room, and the engineer and the producers were in the sound control room. And after a couple of takes, there was a little break, and we were laughing and joking and carrying on. And somebody says, I bet you those white guys ain't never heard black guys sing like that before. And it pissed them off. They cranked the thing up in our, we had the headsets on. They turned it all the way up.
And the comment was heard after that. Well, let's see how good their harmonies will be after that.
It's like somebody sticking an ice pick through you.
It was quite a while in this session before we was able to sing again. We could sing, you know, but we couldn't tell what
still
we were
heard
singing.
That note, that squeaking in our head.
And now we're all suffering from the same thing.
Yeah. To try to destroy our harmonies. But we were recording some of the best material we ever did, and we can still harmonize. What God has put together, let no man put asunder. You know what I'm saying?
That's what you say when you get married.
Well, that's the same thing, isn't it? It means the same thing.
That was George Willie and Joe Chambers. George Chambers died last weekend at the age of 88. And that is our show for today. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb, Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, and Julia Paskin. Valentina Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. And the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Join us back here for the daily version of The Frame on Monday. But before then, stick around and hear some people to tell you how you can help support KPCC.